session number 30304.
Ted Rayner, reel 30.
Keeping the Hudsons ready for operations quickly became a problem, and the four-man ground crew team worked wonders with, as I remember, little help from our hosts. It was obvious that the one aim to them was paramount, ensuring the passage of aircraft to the UK for the American operations against enemy-held Europe continued unabated whenever the weather permitted. They also had the assistance of civilian engineers from the engine and airframe makers. Throughout our stay at the base, the runway was always serviceable in spite of ice, snow, and blizzards, which caused large drifts elsewhere, but never on the runway. In bad weather, it was constantly patrolled by huge blowing and sweeping machines. Hot air machines removed ice from the wings of the aircraft, but on only one occasion could they be spared for use on our Hudsons. So, in preparation for my first patrol from BW1, after briefing and an uncertain weather report, which did at least forecast reasonable conditions in the fjord and at base, as I think we had to spend almost an hour helping the ground crew to chip and scrape ice off to the wing, off the wings and control surfaces. But ready at last, I taxied through what still seems to be the serried ranks of transit aircraft, carried out the cockpit check, and of course turned onto the runway. In the full light of day, it was even more impressive than at dusk on our arrival. It appeared to be almost as wide as the runway at Kaldadarnes in Iceland was long, and the slope down the fjord and the bluff beyond was quite pronounced. As soon as I released the brake, I remember, and before I'd opened the throttles, the Hudson started to move, and in the shortest run I had experienced in the aircraft, even when on some past occasion I might have opened the throttle against the brakes, we were airborne and up to a height of 300 or more feet before we passed over the end of the bottom end of the runway and turned to negotiate the dogleg into the fjord. The effect of the morning sunlight coming from behind the high ground on our left appeared to divide the fjord into two parts, so steep were the sides. Deep shadow to port, stretching more than halfway across the water, and then bright sunlight on the rocky cliff to starboard, which turned grey into shining silver.
Could I just ask about the runway? What was it constructed of, Ted?
Well, presumably, I never saw, actually, I don't think very few of us did. There was always some kind of cover of ice or snow or matted stuff of that type, which had got mixed up with dust and so on. But it, no doubt that they had full equipment for making whatever concrete they needed. So the assumption, I think, must be that it was a what you might call a proper runway. It gave every indication of being that. It was certainly heavily used, even though most of the aircraft were relatively middle range as far as weight was concerned. But before we left at the end of March, there were one or two four-engined Lockheed's transport type of aircraft, four piston engines, of course. We were still in the days of piston engines. But it gave an indication, of course, of how facilities were improving and how well built these things were. I mean, their wooden buildings were much superior to our wooden huts. They were even in plain wood rather than what looked like second-hand stuff that made most of our, certainly wartime built buildings on airfields. So, where are we going? Yes, we made the dogleg into the fjord. But there were ominous signs of a different sort of weather as we turned south over BW3, the island at the bottom of the fjord, as we were looking towards Cape Farewell, or Cape Farewell. And by the time we reached there, large flakes of snow began to impair visibility. Soon became obvious that this was the edge of a continuous belt of wet snow moving up from the south, and ice was beginning to form on the wings. I switched on the de-icing boots and turned to return to base. And an hour after landing, there was a heavy snowfall at base, Blewett West 1, so we had not deserted our post unnecessarily. And this was the kind of frustration which we were to meet on several occasions, and no doubt added to the total frustration of American air crews who may have been sent off only to have to turn back because of failing weather for their next landing. On the 4th of February, I remember it well because it's my birthday, a week after our arrival, Jimmy returned from the control office with the surprising news that we'd been instructed by HQ Iceland to return forthwith. We had begun to realize what could have been achieved from BW1 but had been unable to achieve it so far, whilst at the same time not relishing the circumstances under which we operated and missing the squadron Naus. The next day the weather was unfit for departure, and on the 6th a signal was received cancelling the instructions to return. This volte-face became the subject of speculation, which is not surprising. We get there, we become acclimatized, we make the necessary contacts, and we begin to realize that there is something we can do. We get some cooperation, and then within 10 days, a week perhaps, we get a signal saying we must return, and then on the 2 days later, one cancelling the instructions. So we speculated, but we never guessed what the real reason was. We may come to it in this talk later, but when we got back to Iceland eventually, we found that on the 6th of February, I'm not sure about this, I must check it. One of the speculatory suggestions was that the airfield at Caldudanas might have succumbed to flooding because there was only a wall of ice holding back a considerable amount of water beyond the airfield, and at some stage it was expected to melt. But we'll leave that for later. Well, we managed to keep all aircraft serviceable until the 10th, when, in the absence of instructions from HQ Iceland, and without any possibility of a cooperative enterprise on the base itself, Jimmy's diplomatic contact, at least with the US Navy, led to all our four crews being airborne, together with US Navy aircraft to carry out an anti-U-boat sweep ahead of an American convoy. Then, and that was quite an achievement, we considered, that we'd got cooperation as far as that. Then on the 14th, after a delayed takeoff caused by rundown batteries on the starter trolleys, I continued to sweep for a convoy proceeding towards Bluey West 1. But poor engine starting was one of the symptoms of strain on the system. We relied on the American starter trolleys, and had they previously been used that morning to start their own engines, they had lost their zip by the time we had the use of them. So my next flight was an escort to a convoy passing through the top edge of the gap. After the usual pre-flight preparations of briefing and de-icing, and the promise by the Met people that the 2,000-foot cloud base in the fjord, which would be hiding the tops of the cliffs, was an itinerant cloud base, we again picked up our way through the throng of parked aircraft, wondering why, if a convoy was obliged to risk the icy waters to the south of Greenland, our aircraft was the only one detailed to assist it. The Americans must have known that the very presence of air cover near a convoy was a deterrent to U-boats, would even be a deterrent if the aircraft carried no depth charges or bombs, for the enemy wouldn't know that, and we weren't going to tell him we had no bombs or depth charges on board, and the U-boats wouldn't wait to find out. We had orders to meet the convoy, then sweep ahead, and then behind. We were supposing, just let us suppose, that three of all those serviceable aircraft thwarted in attempts to cross to Reykjavik and UK by the weather over there had accompanied us. We could have supplied simultaneous cover ahead, astern, and on both sides of the convoy. We knew that transit crews were not trained for anti-U-boat work, did most of their navigation along radio beams, but they could have followed a leading aircraft, carried out the sweep, reformed at a rendezvous near the convoy if they wished, or returned by using the radio beam exactly as they did when crossing from Canada. En route to the convoy, the weather deteriorated. The cloud base remained at 2,000 feet, but the wind strengthened from the northeast, whipping up plumes of spray from the wind lanes across the turbulent sea. We approached the convoy, flashing the identification code letter on the Aldrich lamp for some time, but received no reply. Nor could we identify the senior naval officer's vessel. A heavy freezing mist reduced visibility so that we couldn't see the foremost ships in the convoy when we were over the middle of it. And as we passed ahead along the lines, we noticed ice floes and even mini icebergs floating past as the ships plunged so slowly forward. It was as if as if some giant hand had wound up the ships like a clockwork ship and set the rudders, put them into the water on one side of the Atlantic pond, and there they were, with no evidence of life aboard, and not a soul to be seen, moving inexorably towards the other side. It was not a day to be up in the crow's nest. Well, we began to feel there were two gaps. The actual one lacking air cover over in mid-Atlantic, and the one lacking maximum use of Allied resources here. On the 1st of March, 1943, a date forever etched in my memory, a signal was received from Iceland requiring anti-U-boat escort to convoy ON-168. Whilst at BW1, the four crews had been rotated in turn. Jimmy's and mine had been the last to fly, and as two Hudsons were unserviceable and maximum effort was required, it was now down to Harry and Johnny. As usual, we all turned out to help any operational departure. And it could be another incidence of coincidence on this particular day, so far as I and so far as Jimmy Haig were concerned. Marak, the name given to a last resort emergency landing area about halfway up the west coast of Greenland, and Bluey West 8, a satellite airfield at the head of a 50-mile-long fjord even further north, sent weather forecasts before the departure of the two aircraft. Marak at 63 degrees north, 51 degrees west, to provide a good alternative landing. Visibility 30 miles, ceiling 5,000 feet. Okay. Pilots were to return with endurance to reach Marak in case of possible diversion through conditions in the fjord. They stated that the two pilots stated that they would fly out to BW3, the island at the base of our fjord, and consider conditions before carrying out the patrol. There seemed to be quite some importance attached to this convoy, because we did get more cooperation than was usual. And the forecaster stated that the weather conditions in the fjord will probably remain the same throughout the day. The best thing I can do in order to give the detail of this particular day and these aircraft is to read from the squadron's operational record book, which reported as follows. Remembering, of course, that the letter Z after a time indicates local time. 1200 Z, aircraft M, airborne. And that was Flying Officer Ramsey. And at 1252, aircraft O, airborne. And that was Flying Officer Lane. At 1300 hours, weather conditions deteriorated at base. Visibility 1 mile in snow. Consulted weather forecaster who stated that occasional snow showers will be temporarily reducing visibility at base. The control officer was not in the operations room. There's no statement otherwise. We are assuming that Jimmy Haig was the person starting the operations. For instance, where I should have said consulted weather forecaster, that means that Jimmy Haig, our senior officer, consulted the weather forecaster. The control officer was the USAAF officer. So, with this deterioration, Flight Lieutenant Haig decided to recall aircraft in view of bad conditions at base. Signal to both aircraft, return to base. 13:45, signal acknowledged by aircraft O. Incidentally, it was probably not far from the base of the field in that flying time from his takeoff at 12:52 to this receipt of the acknowledgement at 13:45. 13:49, signal acknowledged by aircraft M. And when remembering that he took off at 1200 hours, he was probably about 300 miles away by now. 1400 hours from aircraft M, ETA, estimated time of arrival, 1515Z. Weather conditions at base remained poor, with continuous snow and visibility occasionally clearing from 500 yards to 2 to 3 miles. Conditions at BW3, that's Simiutak at the base of the fjord, were rather better. Visibility 10 miles, ceiling 2,000 feet. 14:05, sent signal, return to base or to Marak, to both aircraft. Acknowledged immediately by M, but no reply from O. Continued to call aircraft O, but no further wireless communication was established. Last contact made at 13:45. 14:10, checked on weather at Marak. Information received in last broadcast, 12:30Z, was visibility 30 miles, ceiling 5,000. Marak broadcasts weather every 6 hours, so requested base forecaster to radio Marak for present weather there at Marak, because it would be a matter of waiting for many hours before the automatically transmitted weather could be received. 14:41, sent base weather, visibility 2 miles, ceiling now down to 600 feet, to aircraft M, which was immediately acknowledged. Wireless difficulties, we were told, made it impossible to obtain present weather from Marak until the automatic 1750. 15:30, aircraft M requested check position of Marak. 15:41, position of Marak sent to M and acknowledged. 1545. For some time, aircraft M had been requesting present weather at Marak, but due to lack of communication, the desired information was still unavailable. The base forecaster could not supply an accurate estimate of the present weather at Marak, but expected to receive this special information by radio at any moment. The army station had been trying to contact Marak since 1400 hours, but received no reply until 1730. In view of the above circumstances, the information re Marak weather desired by M could not at that time be given, and the aircraft was asked to wait. NB, the aircraft had the weather forecast given at the ops briefing for forecast for Marak, but there was no way now, of course, of knowing, of their knowing, whether if any change had occurred. 1630, weather reports from Gotthard and other stations on the coast indicated that the whole of the west coast up to Cruncher Island at the base of the South Strom Fjord leading to Bluey West 8, the satellite airfield, was closing down, and the forecaster stated that Bluey West 8 was the only landing ground with fit conditions. 1637 sent signal, proceed to BW8, field open to aircraft M, immediately acknowledged. 1640, aircraft M requested check position of Bluey West 8. 1655, position of Bluey West 8 sent to M, acknowledged, and aircraft M requested weather at BW8. 1700, replied, ceiling 10,000 feet, visibility 30 miles. NB, weather at Cruncher, ceiling only 5,000 feet, visibility 10 miles. 1710 to aircraft M, request position. 1712, M replied, north of Marak. 1712, sent position, frequency, and call letters of radio beam at Cruncher to M, acknowledged immediately. 1740, sent instructions to aircraft M to enable contact to be made with Bluey West 8 on that station's frequencies. No reply from aircraft M. By this time, the 1730 weather report on Cruncher had been received. Cruncher, the island at the base of the fjord. Visibility 1 mile with snow and gale winds 50 miles an hour from the northeast. No further contact was established with either aircraft in spite of repeated calls. Arrangements were made with naval communications officers to keep a continuous watch all night on frequency 6666 kilocycles. Arrangements were made with Major Lindsay, control officer, to carry out maximum search with all available aircraft, including transit, as soon as possible. Lieutenant Commander Sewell, U.S. Navy, instructed two Navy ships in Tugliarfik Fjord to carry out a search immediately, and one ship in the vicinity of Gotthard to search the coast north of Marak as far as possible.